It's only a colourful plastic laminated card of Arabic script with a picture of a Muslim cleric praying in a prison cell. But it is a key to understanding why some 3,000 Americans lost their lives on the morning of September 11th, 2001. The card was distributed to several of the journalists who were attending bin Laden's press conference, which is how I acquired my copy. The full text of the Arabic on the card, which is reproduced here in full for the first time in English, reads, "My brothers, if they, the Americans, kill me, which they will certainly do, hold my funeral and send my corpse to my family, but do not let my blood be shed in vain. Rather, extract the most violent revenge, and remember your brother who spoke the truth and died for the will of God, the Mujahid Sheikh Omar Abd al-Rahman. In the name of God, the kind and merciful." The fatwa of the prisoner Sheikh Dr. Omar Abd al-Rahman. America is in the process of eliminating the ulama, clergy, who are speaking the truth. And America has suggested to its clients in Saudi Arabia to imprison Sheikh Safar al-Hawali and Sheikh Salman al-Auda and all the others who speak the truth, just as Egypt had done. And the Quran has made a decree upon these Jews and Christians which we have forgotten or allowed to be forgotten. Allah said, "If they could, they will continue to kill you until they make you turn away from your religion." And so all Muslims everywhere, cut off all relations with the Americans, Christians, and Jews. Tear them to pieces. Destroy their economies. Burn their corporations. Destroy their peace. Sink their ships. Shoot down their planes and kill them on air, sea, and land. And kill them wherever ye may find them. Ambush them. Take them hostage. And destroy their observatories. Kill these infidels. Until they witness your harshness, fight them, and God will torture them through your hands, and he will disgrace them, and make you victorious over them. And the nation of the believers is on the verge of creation, and the rage will go from them. Your brother, Omar Abd al-Rahman, from inside the American prisons. Hamid Mir, bin Laden's Pakistani biographer. The language by Sheikh Omar Abd al-Rahman in his will is very, very strong. Up until 1998, bin Laden didn't issue any fatwa or anything against the ordinary Americans. He's against American troops, American government. But Dr. Zawahiri, he is against every American because he is directly affected. His leader, Sheikh Rahman, who is blind, is arrested by the American authorities. If you go through that fatwa, this is the basic ideology of the Al-Qaeda. They say, kill Americans in the air, kill Americans in the borders, kill them everywhere, destroy their companies, everything. So I think what Sheikh Rahman ruled upon in the fatwa, someone is implementing. Algerian Ahmad Ressam plotted to blow up Los Angeles International Airport in December 1999. During mid-1998, he was training at the Khaldan training camp in Afghanistan, which has graduated several of Al-Qaeda's more dangerous alumni. In a subsequent terrorism trial, he testified that Sheikh Rahman's fatwa was widely distributed at the training camp he attended. Ahmed Ressam. A fatwa issued by Sheikh Omar Abd al-Rahman, a piece of paper with his photograph on it, it said it was a fatwa by Omar Abd al-Rahman from prison. It says, fight Americans and hit their interests everywhere. A fatwa is something that a learned person would come up with. If there is an issue that people want an opinion on, the religious learned man would study the issue and pass judgment on whether it was permissible or not. The significance of Sheikh Rahman's fatwa to Al-Qaeda has gone unremarked. Sheikh Rahman's fatwa seems to be the first time that a Muslim cleric had given his religious sanction to attacks on American aviation, shipping, and economic targets. The fatwa, with its exhortations to bring down their airplanes, burn their corporations, and sink their ships, would turn out to be a slowly ticking time bomb that would explode first on October 12, 2000, when a suicide attack blew a hole the size of a small house in the USS Cole in Yemen, killing 17 sailors, and it would explode again with an even greater ferocity on 9/11. To understand the significance of the fatwa, you have to understand the spiritual authority that its author, the militant Egyptian cleric Sheikh Rahman, exercises over al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda may be led by Osama bin Laden and his deputy Ayman al-Zawahiri, but neither of them have any standing as religious scholars, while Sheikh Rahman has a doctorate in Islamic jurisprudence from Al-Azhar University in Cairo, the Harvard of Islamic thought. Indeed, Sheikh Rahman has long been the spiritual guide of Egypt's two most violent terrorist groups, members of which now occupy senior leadership positions within al-Qaeda. The special reverence that al-Qaeda has for Sheikh Rahman is underlined by a two-hour propaganda videotape that the group's media division, known as The Clouds, released sometime in the spring of 2001. Halfway through the tape, in a segment entitled Reasons, bin Laden explains why Muslims should wage a holy war against the United States. Over a picture of Sheikh Rahman, bin Laden fulminates, "He is a hostage in an American jail. We hear he is sick, and the Americans are treating him badly." At a later point on the tape, bin Laden explains, "We consider the American government directly responsible for holding Sheikh Abdul Rahman, whom we consider one of the great scholars of Islam, who is now languishing in jail." Rahman is the only religious figure mentioned in the course of the two-hour videotape. Indeed, the American incarceration of Sheikh Rahman has been a hot-button issue for al-Qaeda for many years. When the Sheikh was arrested in New York in 1993 on terrorism charges, al-Qaeda members based in Sudan debated whether or not to bomb the U.S. embassy in Saudi Arabia in retaliation, a plan that was rejected because of the risk of injury to civilians, scruples the group would later abandon. When al-Qaeda first publicly declared war against the United States in August 1996, bin Laden explained that the Zionist crusaders had arrested the holy warrior Sheikh Rahman. And in 1997, bin Laden told CNN that Sheikh Omar Abdulrahman is a Muslim scholar well known all over the Muslim world. He represents the kind of injustice that is adopted by the U.S. A baseless case was fabricated against him, even though he is a blind old man. The U.S. sentenced him to hundreds of years. He is now very badly treated. In September 2000, Al Jazeera Television aired a videotape of al-Qaeda's leaders in Afghanistan sitting under a banner which read, "Convention to Support Honorable Omar Abdulrahman." On the tape, bin Laden vowed, "We promise to work with all our power to free our brother, Sheikh Omar Abdulrahman." Off camera, one of the Sheikh's sons shouted, "Forward with blood!" This was the first time that a member of Sheikh Rahman's family had publicly identified himself to be part of al-Qaeda. The intense interest that al-Qaeda has taken in the fate of Sheikh Rahman may come as something of a surprise to most Americans who, if they remember him at all, may dimly recall television pictures of the corpulent cleric when he lived in New York in the early 90s, invariably dressed in flowing robes, wearing a red felt hat denoting his senior clerical status, and dark sunglasses that disguised his blind, opaque eyes. On television, Sheikh Rahman came off like a cuddly Middle Eastern Father Christmas who had somehow morphed into Ray Charles. The reality is more sinister. The blind Sheikh is the zealot of Islamist terrorism, repeatedly cropping up as the spiritual inspiration or instigator of the most spectacular terrorist attacks of the past two decades. From the 1981 assassination of Egyptian President Anwar Sadat in Cairo to the 9/11 plot itself. Sheikh Rahman is important to al-Qaeda not only because of the high regard the terrorist organization has for him as a religious scholar, but also because he has long been the spiritual guide of the Egyptian militants who are at the heart of al-Qaeda's operation. It is a fact little understood in the West that while bin Laden, a Saudi exile, is the public face of al-Qaeda, its key members are Egyptian, and the terrorist organization's ideology and tactics first emerged in Egypt. The ideological godfather of al-Qaeda is the Egyptian writer Sayyid Qutb, whose brother Muhammad influenced bin Laden when he was a college student in Saudi Arabia. All three of al-Qaeda's successive military commanders have been Egyptian. First, Abu Ubaidah al-Banshiri, who died in 1996, then Mohammed Atef, who was killed in the Afghan War in 2001, and now Saif Adel, a former Egyptian army officer who is presently in Iran. The lead 9/11 hijacker, Mohammed Atta, was an Egyptian, while one of the key signatories of bin Laden's 1998 declaration of war against the United States, Rafai Ahmed Taha, is a leader of Egypt's terrorist Islamic group. Rafai Taha made the following statement in 2000. Regarding the case of Omar Abdulrahman, the Islamic group spiritual leader who is detained in a U.S. jail, the policy of talking and making threats is over. We will address the United States in a language that it understands. I believe the time to do so is drawing near. Sheikh Rahman's fatwa to attack the U.S. economy and American aviation was an important factor in the 9/11 attacks. Al-Qaeda's Egyptian leaders wanted to exact revenge on the United States for the imprisonment and ill-treatment of their spiritual guide. At the same time, Sheikh Rahman gave his followers his spiritual sanction for terrorist attacks. Sheikh Rahman's fatwas are the nearest equivalent that al-Qaeda has to an ex-cathedra statement by the Pope. As someone with a doctorate in Islamic law, for Islam is a religion of laws much like Orthodox Judaism, Sheikh Rahman was able for the first time in al-Qaeda's history to rule that it was legally permissible and even desirable to carry out attacks against American planes and corporations. Exactly the type of attacks that took place on 9/11. Indeed, up until 9/11, al-Qaeda had confined its attacks to American governmental and military targets and had eschewed attacks on American corporations and airliners. Further, in 1996, a pamphlet was published by supporters of Sheikh Rahman in the U.S. entitled My Testimony to History. In the pamphlet, which shows a photograph of Sheikh Rahman in a wheelchair in a U.S. prison, the cleric is quoted in a similar language to the will that was distributed at the press conference in Afghanistan, saying, "Take revenge on whomever kills me. Do not let my blood be shed in vain." Of course, it is possible that Sheikh Rahman, who has been incarcerated in American prisons since 1993, did not write the fatwa himself. However, in the past, Sheikh Rahman's incarceration has not prevented him from communicating important messages to his followers through his family or lawyers. For instance, in 1997, he endorsed a ceasefire between the Egyptian government and the terrorist Islamic group. Then in 2000, Sheikh Rahman publicly withdrew his support from that ceasefire. In his 2001 autobiography, Al-Zawahiri approvingly noted that people of the stature of Omar Abdulrahman oppose the ceasefire initiative. We will simply never know if Rahman did write the fatwa or whether al-Qaeda's leaders wrote it and presented it as the cleric's fatwa. In either case, the al-Qaeda leadership knew that they needed some theological cover for their future campaign against American civilians, and that only someone of Sheikh Rahman's stature could provide that cover. Abu Walid al-Misri was the editor of Al-Imara, the Emirate magazine, the Arabic language magazine of the Taliban. And he also wrote a book about the Afghan Arabs, serialized in Al-Sharq al-Awsat newspaper in December 2004. An extract follows. During this period, 1996 to 1998, it was noticeable that bin Laden was maniacally obsessed with the media, especially international media. Mullah Omar's greatest failure was his inability to shut up al-Qaeda's leader. The Taliban ministers used to come from Kabul to Jalalabad out of courtesy to bin Laden, and sometimes to consult him about some technical issues in their ministries, especially issues related to agriculture, electricity, and construction. They knew about his experience in these issues, and perhaps they were hoping that he would throw his weight behind the construction of the Afghan Islamic Emirate, as he had done previously in Sudan. Bin Laden did not stint in his advice, but he was very close to financial bankruptcy. The visits were at the instructions of Mullah Omar, who wanted to convey to bin Laden the message, "We will consider you as one of us, but do not address the media." However, bin Laden proved that he was prepared to sacrifice Afghanistan and Mullah Omar rather than stop talking. Then the U.S. television stations entered the arena, and the media noise around bin Laden escalated to a maximum. In turn, bin Laden, with every atom of his personality, became more enthusiastic about talking. The appeals by Mullah Omar himself and through his prime minister and foreign minister were useless. These cries and appeals poured down during the last 2 months of 1996. On the surface, bin Laden agreed with them on this, but he proved that he was the only person in Afghanistan who thought that he had the right and the ability to do whatever he wanted. By this, he was able to drive the Islamic march in Afghanistan over the precipice. Control of bin Laden was not easy. His gentle disposition hides a wild horse that no one can control, nor can he control himself. Rick Bennett is a Canadian freelance cameraman. In the past decade and a half, he has worked mostly for ABC News, covering the first Gulf War in 1990 and the wars in Somalia and Bosnia in the mid-90s. In the spring of 1998, he received a call about going to Afghanistan. The assignment was to film an interview with Osama bin Laden, working with ABC News correspondent John Miller. "I was approached about doing this interview. I talked to two or three of the staff cameramen at ABC News who thought it was a bit risky, and it obviously was. My thinking was, let's give it a try. I certainly had heard about bin Laden, and I went to the ABC research department and I got any reading material I could about his background. I didn't quite appreciate at the time how strong a following he had or how popular he was becoming within the Muslim world. It was my first time into Afghanistan. It was like being in a different time, a different planet almost. I remember at times just driving through these villages and people living in mud houses. You had to remind yourself what century it was. It was that kind of experience. How poor people were, how they lived, how remote it was, and how barren it was. I guess having been on other trips into places like Somalia and having worked in the Third World, I sort of took it in my stride. I wasn't too worried about it. There wasn't really any anxiety at this stage. In some respects, maybe that was a bit naive. And certainly as we got closer and were driving up this mountain in the middle of the night, I did think at that stage, what the hell have I got myself into? But early on, it was a bit of an adventure. New place, new people. That is why I got into the business after all. By dusk, we ended up at this camp. As we arrived, I remember there was a fenced-off area in the mountain, and there were two gun emplacements. And there we stayed for a number of days. I was a bit surprised. It seemed more like a military camp than I had thought, and was relatively well organized in terms of the structure of the place. We ended up staying there 3 evenings in the end, and they always kept us guessing. We were never told when we would meet him, how we would meet him. Right around this time, we were handed over to this guy who spoke perfect English. When you think about al-Qaeda, you think these guys are uneducated and easily brainwashed. But no, this guy in particular, I felt he was very much his own man. Very articulate, very well-spoken. These guys would show up, the elders. They would meet with us, then go into a separate room and have a discussion. It would go back and forth. John Miller, ABC News correspondent. We are introduced to al-Qaeda's leaders. Ayman al-Zawahiri is all about the message. "We are so pleased to have you here, and you are welcome," in perfect English, and Mohammed Atef is all about the security. He's got his people rifling through our bags and checking our stuff, and he is not very friendly. They take us to a collection of maybe 4 huts, and inside there were flannel blankets laid out on the floor and wall-to-wall carpeting and a couple of pillows, and they said, "This is where you will sleep." They said, "We know that this is not what you are used to, but around here in these camps," Zawahiri says, "this is the Ritz." And he said, "You are not prisoners, you are guests, but we ask that you stay inside." So we stayed there for about 2 to 3 days. Zawahiri, a smart guy, that was my short-range take on him. My long-range take, reflecting back on the trip later, was that he was running the show and that he was running bin Laden. Zawahiri was to Osama bin Laden what Karl Rove is to the White House. I mean, he crafted the message, he called the tunes. Bin Laden seemed to be the inspirational leader, the front guy. You know, the guy that they would put out on camera. But the guy who was working on policy and deciding the direction, on reflecting back, seemed to be Zawahiri. He came back the next day and he said, "We would like to know what questions you are going to ask Mr. bin Laden in this interview." I gave him a little journalism 101 about we don't really go into questions. But then I looked around at the 5 guys with the AK-47s and I said, "Look, have you got a pad?" So I wrote out off the top of my head about 16 questions. Zawahiri's rationale, by the way, was based on solid journalistic grounds. He said, "We are going to use our translator, and if he can have the questions in writing, he can write them in Arabic so that when you ask your number one question and he reads his number one, they are exactly the same." I wrote out 16 questions. Did you pay for the bombing of the World Trade Center in 1993? Did you know Ramzi Youssef? Did you plan to assassinate Clinton and the Pope? And then, a boilerplate one at the end. Is there any message that you have for America? Rick Bennett. They ultimately came in and said, "Today we go." It must have been afternoon. We were like, "Go where?" They said, "Tonight we go do the interview." They wouldn't give us much more than that. We were pretty well stripped of all our personal possessions to make certain, I guess, we didn't have any homing devices, any transmitters. And they brought us into the back of this vehicle. There were really no roads. It was all riverbeds and off-road, and was very hard going, bumping all over the place up this mountainside. On 3 occasions along the way, we would be driving along, and all of a sudden these guys would just appear behind the bushes carrying AK-47s and grenade launchers. They'd jump out of the bushes and point all their weapons at us, which were extremely intimidating, as you can imagine. We were told to keep quiet no matter what happens. At one stage, they would open a door to the vehicle and hold a gun to your head and a torch to your eyes. I remember thinking at one stage, this is just designed to intimidate, so stay cool. But it was obviously having the designed effect. I was obviously very freaked out by it, but at this stage, there's no going back. You can't say, "This isn't fun anymore, I've changed my mind." So you forge ahead. As we came to the summit, just before we hit the ridge at the top of this mountain, this guy jumps from behind a rock and starts shooting his gun off, and from where I was, I couldn't tell if he was shooting at us, if he was trying to stop the vehicle. There was quite an open plateau at the top of this mountain, and there were 4 large gun emplacements on the top of this mountain. And as we arrived, I recall there were 2 buildings, both of which were probably 40 feet by 20 feet, rectangular-shaped buildings. They took us into one of the buildings and said he would be arriving any time, and I said, "Listen, I need my camera. What's going on?" They replied, "We have a camera for you." And they gave me this little Panasonic DV camera, and I said, "Well, that's fine, but I need my lights. How can I light this interview without them?" Then I realized the camera had been brought up in another vehicle. But where it was and how to get access to it was another story. So I set up my lights. John Miller. So we get up there, and there's kind of a production. There are generators that are going, and there are lights that are set up, and there's a big tent and a little hut, and then there's a big gathering of people in a semicircle, like 100. And Ayman al-Zawahiri is there, and he says, "I have very good news for you. Mr. bin Laden has agreed to answer each of your questions." And I said, "That's terrific." he said. There is one other thing, though. For procedure, we will not translate his answers. I said, you know, that can't really work because I won't know what he's saying. How am I going to ask the follow-up questions? He said, this will be no problem. There will be no follow-up questions. I kept thinking if the boys at the White House could get a press policy like this, life would be so easy for them. So that didn't go over too well, but I was also happy that we were going to be able to ask him everything that was on my list, because some of it was fairly provocative. I had asked about B-roll, pictures of an interview subject doing something other than being interviewed, of Bin Laden around the camps, and Zawahiri said, this is not like your Sam Donaldson and the president walking through the Rose Garden. Mr. Bin Laden is a very important man. I explained to him, we are not just going to put Bin Laden on for half an hour talking. We need to build a story around elements. He said, elements, we will get you elements. So they had apparently staged what was about to take place based on my request for B-roll. So Bin Laden arrives, gets out of an orange SUV, and a whole bunch of bodyguards get out around him, and everybody starts firing into the air. This, I guess, is what Zawahiri meant when he said there is always a great celebration when Mr. Bin Laden comes. Everybody's shooting, and rockets are going up, and tracer bullets. I thought it was an interesting way to welcome a guy. I also was looking at this big security phalanx around him, saying, how do you secure a guy when everybody's instructions are to open fire? I got what was going on. They were doing this for us. We needed some footage, and they needed to put on a show. Rick Bennett. I just finished setting up the lights, and all of a sudden all hell is breaking loose. It's like World War III is happening outside the door. So I come rushing out, and I see 45 or 50 of his men all firing their automatic weapons up in the air. These heavy weapons, gun emplacements, they're all firing. There's red tracer fire shooting up into the sky. John Miller. So, Bin Laden is ushered straight past me while this kid is shooting his AK-47 in my ear. I actually pushed the barrel away, and he put it right back up, so I'm now deaf in one ear at least. First of all, I'm shocked. The guy is huge. He's like 6'5". There weren't a whole lot of big guys in the camp, so to see him kind of above the heads of this phalanx of bodyguards, he was like a giraffe. I'm introduced to him. We shake hands. It's not like a great handshake. It's kind of like, yeah, I've got to shake your hand handshake. And he sits down on a kind of a little bench, and he's got a map of the world behind him, which I thought was instructive also. I think they were trying to transmit Al-Qaeda is a worldwide organization and that Bin Laden is the leader of it, and he had his AK-47 with him, and he kind of laid it gently against the back wall, and he was a little impatient, as were his aides, about how long it'll take to set up the lights. It was hard to form impressions of a guy that you couldn't really converse with, but they were that he was a spiritual man. He had a kind of calm in him that I didn't expect. What I expected was somebody in the mold of the blind sheikh, the Egyptian cleric Sheikh Omar Abdulrahman, a fiery orator who would be pumping his fist and saying a lot of things at the top of his lungs. If you didn't lean into Bin Laden, you couldn't hear him as he spoke in a very kind of almost high-pitched but very soft voice. He also struck me as a teacher. He looked you right in the eye, and he would stay looking in your eye, but then he would kind of drift off us as he was reaching for a thought. His deputies looked up to him as a great leader and a guy that they would follow into anything. There is that charismatic aura or a scent that make people follow him. Either you have it or you don't. They spoke of him with godlike reverence and then meeting him. And you saw the way they greeted him, the way they sent him off, and the way they talked with great excitement about the sheikh. They had a little Panasonic Al-Qaeda camera there, and Rick Bennett said, I'm not shooting it with that. And I'm like, Rick, you know, we've come a long way to do this. Let's go along to get along. And he said, no, sometimes in this culture you have to put your foot down and say, that's it. And you'll be surprised how quickly they fold. Rick Bennett. So my strategy was at this stage I need to have my camera. So I made this big scene in front of Bin Laden, the idea being if I make his people look bad in front of him, I might get somewhere. And sure enough, my camera appeared. Just before we were about to sit down and start rolling, Osama insisted that everybody leave because there were too many insects, too many mosquitoes or whatever in the building. We had to spray for insects. I remember thinking, this is not a guy who lives in a cave. The other thing I noticed on first meeting him was he was immaculately dressed. When he first walked into the room, he definitely had a presence. I'm 6'2", and he towered above me. You could tell his men when they all came in around him, they sort of worshipped the ground this man walked on. Before we started the interview, he insisted everybody clear off because there were far too many flies and mosquitoes in the room. So everybody left, and it was this bizarre moment when it was just myself and Osama in this room. And one of the other guys came in and sprayed all this insect repellent. And it was just a bit surreal to be standing in the room with this guy. We didn't really discuss anything. I mean, I'm quite certain he speaks English, but he certainly wasn't willing to speak English with us. When we first met, he shook my hand. He was very gentle, mild-mannered, very soft-spoken. Not sort of a raving lunatic or anything. Not really what I expected, to be honest. The interview started and John asked his questions in English, and Osama answered in Arabic. John Miller. I asked him, what about the World Trade Center bombing in 1993? It's not like fighting the Russians on the field of battle. This is targeting innocents and civilians. And he said, this is a very strange question coming from an American. Was it not your country that bombed Nagasaki and Hiroshima? Were there not women and children and civilians and non-combatants there? You were the people who invented this terrible game, and we as Muslims have to use those same tactics against you. It was a very well-formed argument. He said, I predict a black day for America, a day after which America will never be the same, and the states will not be united. And he pretty much laid it out that this would be a sustained battle. And at that point, he went into one of the answers that we ended up playing a lot, which is he had this message for America, and the one that always struck me because it sounded hyperbolic at that time. I'm declaring war on the United States. I'm going to attack your country. And I thought, yeah, you and what army? If you took those words and you played them on September 12th, 2001, as opposed to, say, September 9th, 2001. It went from sounding quite hyperbolic to, he was telling us all along. Rick Bennett. So once we finish the interview, I break free. I start shooting cutaways and wide shots of the room. During the whole interview, Osama had his AK-47 sitting on his lap, and I remember doing a shot from the AK up to him. The room was a long, rectangular room and had a map of the world behind him. That was the background to the interview. So I kept rolling. Osama got up and I thought, this is my opportunity. So I ran outside and turned on the top light and waited for him to emerge into the darkness. So he comes out of the building and I follow him. He has all his men around him. That's when I shot all that footage of him walking, getting into the vehicle. When all this is happening, everybody is firing their weapons off. It's complete madness. He gets into the vehicle, and he drives off. These guys keep firing their weapons. So I shoot video of them all firing their weapons off. When we first arrived, these guys that really intimidated me were these young guys who were in their late teens, early 20s, who had obviously been there for a while, had obviously been under the influence of Al-Qaeda, and would just as soon shoot us dead as deal with us. You could just tell from the look in their eyes that they wanted us dead. These guys really worried me. The young guys would try and intimidate you, run up to you, put a weapon to your ear, and fire off half a dozen rounds to try and take your eardrum out. Well, then they insisted we stay and have a chicken dinner. At this stage, I had no appetite. We got what we wanted. It was time to go, so let's get the hell off this mountain. So I packed my camera and started walking towards our vehicle to find that Tariq, our fixer-translator, is involved in this huge argument with two of these young guys who had guns. I said, Tariq, what the hell are you doing? These guys have the guns. He said, they're insulting me. They're saying I'm a traitor, that I'm with the West. I'm telling them we've been invited by Osama. We're his personal guest. How can they be treating us this way? At this point, I said, I don't give a shit. They have the guns. We have what we want. Let's get the hell out of here. Obviously, there was huge relief once we were actually on our way out, and we had actually survived this ordeal, because there were a couple of times along the way when I wasn't sure that I was going to make it back. At the time, I thought it was quite a coup to get the interview, but I didn't quite appreciate the significance because September the 11th hadn't happened. It was just such a great sense of relief to get back into Pakistan. It's funny, it's all relative. Pakistan seemed like a very normal, safe place after Afghanistan. To get back to the hotel room was a huge relief. I remember getting into the room and calling for room service and getting 6.5-liter bottles of water. And having suffered from dehydration before, I knew all the symptoms. Dizziness, headache, and one of the symptoms, that you're not thirsty. So I took all these 6 bottles and drank every last drop. It was either that or go to the hospital. We did an hour special on ABC Nightline with Ted Koppel hosting the show. I remember it going to air and him starting out the whole hour saying, "Tonight we are going to introduce you to the man who poses the greatest threat to America, and it's a name that nobody has ever even heard of, and his name is Osama bin Laden."